Hey everyone, my name is Ray Boyce and this is the Startup Specialist Podcast. Today we have Sid Moseb, who is a founder, entrepreneur, and investor, and he's going to share his journey of immigrating to the US and building multiple businesses. And now he's an investor and a professor, and he teaches about venture capital and business to other founders and entrepreneurs like us. So Sid, why don't you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Sure. As you said, I'm an immigrant. I came here a long time ago when I was 16 years old. I built my first company when I was in college and sold that. And then for about 10 years or so, I was a partner of a consulting firm and we helped very large companies. Then I started doing leverage buyouts in buying companies or carve outs and turning them around. And after I sold one of my companies, I turned into an angel investor, made lots of investments in early stage companies, and then I jumped into one of my portfolio companies and sold that company to KPMG, which is a $26 billion advisory and accounting firm. I was the head of the national head of a strategic innovation, and for the past 6 or 7 years, I write books. I've got a couple of books around entrepreneurship, around running companies, and using data and analytics and things of that sort. Role of AI, the entrepreneurship mindset. And I've been also in the past 6 or 7 years teaching at USC, both in engineering school and in business school. And I still do investments and help early stage companies.
So there's a lot to learn here. Why don't we start with your journey as an immigrant into the business world, right? What sort of challenges you think you have faced as an immigrant that other people who are native citizens aren't facing?
Well, I think they're the obvious ones. One is that when you're an immigrant, you don't have the network of friends and family and all of that to be able to support you. So that's a major one because you don't have the connections. Obviously, you don't know the lay of the land. You don't know how to do certain things. If you have someone who has walked the journey before, they know how to go to a bank, how to open a company, how to do all the little bitty things. The connections to customers, all of that, obviously, if you have a network and a family and a structure that's pre-existing, makes a big difference. One could also say that it could be a hindrance because as somebody who doesn't know anything and doesn't have the connections, you have to create a lot more focus, which is a key element in making a company work and be successful. And you have to hustle and learn how to build the trust with people, how to deliver on trust, and how to walk the talk and figure out what the how to stay relevant. I think it could be looked at as a positive or a negative, depending on how you see the world, half full, half empty, essentially.
Right. So some of our other friends are also immigrant founders in the US, right? So I'm going to just tell you the top three challenges that they tell me that they are facing, and I want you to tell me what are the most viable solutions that you think they can implement when some of our audience members are gonna do that sort of thing where they are an immigrant and they are doing business. Okay, so the first challenge they face is related to credit scores, where they can't secure a lot of loans and stuff for their business. So how do you think they should overcome that challenge?
Credit scores, there are two kinds of credit scores. One is a personal credit score or the FICO score. The other one is a Dun & Bradstreet as far as a company is concerned. The company, regardless of if you're from here or an immigrant, is the same thing. You have to build a company, you have to deliver, you have to gain access, pay people in the right way and so forth for that to be built. So that's irrelevant to the immigrant situation. But if you don't have a FICO score, that limits you from other aspects. That's a lot of people that start a business, depending on how you look at it. If, you know, a lot of people now look at a venture capital kind of stuff, getting money from third parties. There has to be certain characteristics to deals like that. It has to be scalable, it has to be big, it has to be, it's just a different animal than if you want to, you know, start up a business as a restaurant owner or as a small business owner, as an insurance advisor. There's lots of businesses out there, and a significant portion of them are not venture capital backed. So if the challenge of the FICO score comes to place where you've built a business. Now you need to get loans to deal with working capital issues or things of that sort, or scaling issues. And two co elements come in. One is the business actually running, and is it making money, and is profitable, and is structured? So that becomes more of an accounting management deal. You know, a lot of early stage people that haven't done business, their books is a little bit of a shambles. So that's the first thing to fix. The second thing is, if you go to a bank and you want to get credit, then your FICO score, personal FICO score, comes into play, because they want you to personally guarantee things. A lot of early stage or startup companies don't want to do that, and that's where the rub is. Basically, if you're starting a business, that means you believe in yourself and what you can do. Now, are there ways that you can clean up your FICO score? Yeah, there are a lot of companies that help you get rid of debt or bad decisions in the past to clean that up. But I would say, as if you're starting a business, the first thing is to focus on customers, value propositions, and if there's something that people would look at as valuable to get from your business, then things would start changing in the right direction. If you're trying to basically get money from somebody else, bank or an individual, and try to prove things out, that would prove to be a little more difficult.
Okay, that's very interesting. The second challenge they face is very tied to your answer to the first one. The thing is, a lot of immigrant founders are having residency issues where they can't navigate the system well enough. They just want to come in and build a company, but they do not understand the sort of residency and visa issues they are going to face. So, do you think there's a pressure to get funding from VCs so they can get a more favorable residency permit deal?
So, I'm not sure if your question is about residency. You mean in America, residency in America, or resistance to getting started? So clarify that one for me.
It's about, see, the what goes on usually is the founders who are immigrating for business reasons, they often face challenges like what sort of visa or residency they should apply for to get that result, right? So what happens is they often apply to accelerators and to get funding from VCs, which usually what happens is their lawyers or consultants tell them that if you are VC backed, you are going to get a more favorable business permit or a more favorable residency permit. So they do face that pressure to get funding from VCs, even if they are using a direct response funding method or that sort of stuff, right? So what is your opinion and your solutions for that for them?
So, I'm not an immigration attorney, so why you have to take that filter on. But basically, I think the assumption or the hypothesis is that if you have a idea that the venture capital has backed, that idea has more valid issues and so forth. But you still have to go through the structure that is there in normal pace. So it's like, if I have $500,000 in my bank or $250,000, would I get a better immigration looking? Yes. If I have a job from Johnson and Johnson or IBM that has offered me something and they recognize me, would I get a better? Oh, of course. So it reduces the risk, but it does not eliminate it. And I think the biggest challenge is not the residency issue, it's the practicing and perspective issue. Let me explain. A lot of people come from overseas, name it wherever it is. Most of the issues overseas are in production problems. That is, getting the material, assembling things, they are mechanical availability of the machines, of the people, of the. That's not an American issue. The American issue is a marketing and sales issue. And most of them may be even good business people, and they think that, hey, if I have something good, it would sell. It won't. So a lot of the failures that I've seen is not because people are smart. They're very smart, they have good ideas. They know how to assemble things, and they, if you have money, you can build anything here in America. You can pick up the phone and order 10,000 things inventory to show up at your door in a week. But that doesn't necessarily make it a good business. It's just your spending is easy. So the key thing is often the major problem is the understanding of the business differences overseas and in the United States. I've seen very successful people that have built great businesses overseas to come to the United States and fail because they're focused on getting a good product built or solving the challenges of production, but they're not good at product positioning and branding and sales. And all of that, and that makes a big difference. In terms of again the immigration visas and so forth, I'm not the right guy to be able to provide the right advice. But I have not seen, based on I've been doing this for quite a bit, I have not seen a significant difference. It may be that some incubators or accelerators, in order to make some money or do some stuff, promote that kind of thing. And maybe they have found a loophole of some sort, but in my experience, it doesn't make that much of a difference.
Wait, so for those of us who are trying to pitch to a VC or an accelerator or investor, what is your advice for them?
So here's what you've got to understand. Over 99%, that is almost one in a thousand company that's looking for venture money gets money. So the odds are significantly against people who are raising money. That's one. Two is I've seen a lot of businesses that are good businesses, but they're lifestyle businesses. They're great businesses that could make a lot of money, but they're not venture capital businesses for obvious reasons. So people have to understand first the math of venture capital. And the math is very important. Most of the time you have a venture capitalist, that person, and forget about the angels. If you have a venture capitalist, 9 out of 10, almost 9.9 out of 10, there is very little money that that person puts in the fund, and majority of the money is coming from somebody else, from other investors, from venture partners, from institutions, depending on the size of the venture capital. So that person is an administrator of that fund and makes a decision based on the guidelines of the fund, which is usually, not all the time, you need to get to an exit within 5 to 7 years. You may have an extension up to 10 years. So what they're looking for is for a deal that they can give some money and it could expand to exit within 5 to 7 years. That's a pretty fast-growing deal. Then if they give the guidelines as maybe get 10x or in some cases 100x their money, that means if they give you $1 million, they want to pick up $100 million, right? And their objective is to sell the company. Their objective is not to get profits or dividends. Those are different kinds of investors. VCs want to get in, scale the company, make it big, and exit. So if you want to sell a company at $100 million and the VC owns, let's say, 20%, that company should be $500 million in 5 years from scratch. That's a big Big deal. It's not easy. And not every company can do that. Not every idea is good for that. So the nature of the deal makes them either qualify or not qualify for a particular venture investment scenario. Then you have the angel investors, and now angels have moved up also in terms of the stream to spend more money because there's a lot better deals. And they want the team to be developed. Why? Because they're reducing their risk. They want the product to be in the market and sold because it's so the people look at these Mark Zuckerbergs of the world and they all say, oh, we don't need to have education and we don't need to have this. And if we have an idea, we could become a trillionaire. Well, those guys are one in 100 million. They're not even one in a million. They're one in 100 million. And by the way, they say Zuckerberg didn't go to school. Zuckerberg was at Harvard. Zuckerberg reads a lot. He's a smart guy. He was already connected when he got to Harvard. You and I can't get into Harvard. Bill Gates was connected. I mean, these guys were not like bozos off the street. They were really Bill Gates reads. I've read some places of up to 7 to 10 books a week. So he's not, yes, he didn't graduate, but he's an educated guy who reads a lot and explores a lot. So the illusion of, hey, if I have an idea, I could make $1 trillion and I could be in, let's get the money from VCs, doesn't work. The other thing is a lot of entrepreneurs think that if they go to VC, it's like securing a job. The VCs are not interested in giving you a job. That's a company. You want a job, you go work for somewhere. It's a partnership structure. It's something that they have to believe that you are flexible, that you're not just doing this as a job, you're doing it as a partner. And the characteristics of the entrepreneur has to be pretty well defined. The growth mindedness, the exit mindedness, the ability to be coached, the ability to be flexible in ideas and things. And all of those come, it's not just if you're smart. So all of those makes a difference in if they qualify for a VC, but it's one in less than 1,000. Is that good? No, but that wasn't that's not necessarily how businesses are built. Significant number of businesses never received VC money and became pretty big. This is an illusion that we have that you have to have somebody else's money in order to build things. Now, is it easier? Of course it's easier. Of course it's easier.
Okay, so let me ask you this. For someone like myself, I have always taken on debt for my businesses to grow them that way. And I've never taken any VC money or any investor money, and at least not for like cash for stock, right? I've taken debt, but I've never given away stock of my own companies, okay? So what do you think are the merits and demerits of funding yourself via getting in debt or getting versus funding yourself via VC money, right? Because I funded my own companies via taking on debt and then building my own runway through the sales we were getting. But now I help founders get funded by VCs and private equity and angel investors, and I also consult with private equity and VCs and other angel investors. So what do you think are the merits and demerits of both, right? Because I talk about this a lot, but it would be a great help coming from someone like you.
Sure. So, right, the thing is, first of all, good for you. If you can manage not to get money from somebody else like me, who is going to interfere in your business, who's going to be a partner, who's going to push you for an exit, who's going to do a lot of stuff that would be forcing you to execute differently. And you can maintain your equity because that's the most expensive thing you have. Good for you. That's what you should do. That's the idea of building a business. Yeah, you take the risk and you take the benefits. If you believe in your company, then it's the right thing to do. Now, again, getting VC money, you mentioned private equity, and we could talk about that a little bit too. Getting VC money requires a certain kind of company that you can't do it with $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 worth of debt. Or you're at the point that you could be making $1 million a year versus $50 million a year, and the idea is that you have to do mass marketing and hire hundreds of salespeople or whatever in order to get there. So you're going for market share, and that requires you to compromise on profit. Compromise, and so it's not necessarily the first stages. It's you're trying to scale, and that's what VC money is for. But again, it has to be a company that can make 10x or 100x. No VC wants to take control of your business. That's not what they do. They like to go sit on a yacht, do their thing, and let you at 4 o'clock in the morning worry about what the business is making or not making. So they're not interested in taking majority control. Now, let's take the private equity firms. Private equity firms are a different animal. Their scale of exit is 3 to 5 years, not 3x, not 10x. So they actually invest in later stage companies when it's built, when the model is proven, when it's got EBITDA, when the EBITDA is reasonable, and all that, and they can clearly see, usually on the cost-cutting measure. Yes, some do invest on the growth, but can we restructure this? Can I take this business, put it as a part of another business that I have, so that I give it another channel that exists already? So can I make this a platform and then bring three other things underneath it to do this? So the decision-making process for private equity is often different, and they like to take control. So usually those cases are where the entrepreneur is selling a piece of business and is taking some money off the table. Now, are there exceptions? Of course there are. But generally, the private equity doesn't come in to give you money so that you can execute and take 10% of the deal. It's a different animal, and they do it based on EBITDA. They have some structures in their funds, how they deploy the money, how the company has to retire the debt that they may take in the acquisition. It's a little bit more complicated, if you would, than the VC money. So the VC will give you the money and say, let's go exit, and they take less than 25, 30%. The private equities would say, here's some money. You can take some money off the table because you've done such a great job. I now have control. Now, if you want to build this with me, it's 60-40. It's 70-30. It's 51-49. Now you can make more money, and we can make it together. And I don't expect a 20x or 10x or 100x. I expect a 3-4x of the exit, and we're still trying to sell this within 3 to 5 years, or 4, 5 to 7 years. Does that help?
Right, so what I basically understand here is a lot of stars have to align before you are trying to sell to the VCs or the private equity or any other investor. So you should really target a specific investor profile if you are reaching out for funding for others, right?
Correct. Have to align. You have to start align a lot of stars. There's a different story.
Right, so in order to align them, I would also like some pitch deck building tips and VC pitching tips from you. So, what do you have for us?
So there's everybody that makes investments has their own thoughts and successes and failures. So everybody has their own formula. I can tell you what I think. The thing that I mostly am looking for is this idea of exchange. And exchange means that what you have is solving a problem, not that you think it's a problem, that the clients think it's a problem, and that they are willing to pay for this problem. So it's not just, oh, it's a big problem to solve, or it's an interesting thing to solve, but they actually are are realizing that it is, and they're willing to exchange their expertise, their time, their money with what you have. Okay, so that's the number one I'm looking for. And obviously, if it's a VC deal, that problem has to be big and represent a big market. Now, some people like entrepreneurs to do this TAM and SAM and all that sort of stuff. Those are, significantly made up. So if the problem is, if you tell me, hey, I'm solving the problem of, I don't know, breast cancer, it's big. You don't need to multiply numbers for me. Right? I get it. For example, I'm completely against people coming in and say, this is a $3 billion market, and if I get 1%, then look at how I'm going to be doing. I don't want you to get 1%. I want you to get 100%. That's why you're here. This is not a game of, oh, if it's this big and I get this much of it, it's great. No, I don't want you to get. Give me a market that you can really penetrate and get. So that's one. The other thing is a lot of people focus on the solution, but solution is a means to an end. Let me explain. So you have a big problem, a worthy problem to follow, to solve. And then you have your solution that solves that problem. But what really people buy is not your solution. They buy the value exchange. They buy what value are you delivering to me that I am willing to pay for. So your solution is a means to an end. It is not the end. Just because you have technology, that doesn't mean you have. The other thing I look for is this notion of a lot of people use MVPs and the minimum viable product, and they forget that it's not viable because you had not enough money or you had, oh, I had this much money, so I built this and this is the minimum viable product. No, viability has to do with the customer, not you. It's irrelevant how much money you have. What's relevant is viability to the customer. Is it viable to them? Is it enough that they would pay you something? So that kind of I think addresses the market and the product stuff that I'm looking for. So if that's communicated in the pitch, great. The other thing is the team and the coachability of the team. That is, it doesn't matter if they failed. What matters is how they got up. It doesn't matter if they have three people from IBM or Microsoft or some big companies involved, because those guys are usually don't know how to run a startup business. They like their martini lunches and first class travels and a this and a that. They need three secretaries. I'm looking for somebody who's rolling up their sleeves and getting into dirt. And that means that they have to be coachable, they have to be flexible. Why flexible? Because when I was running Techos Angels and had my fund, I would see maybe over 2,000, 2,500 deals a year. Out of those, I would physically talk to about 400. And we made 10 investments. So now, I have not seen, and this could be me, I have not seen any business plan that anybody has produced over all of these 20 some odd years that I've been doing this that got to exit with the same original business plan. The same thing that they started with didn't end up being what they did. So the market is going to push back. The market defines what's relevant, not that you're smart and you have this. And what that becomes, neither one of us know. So, for example, the guy who invested in Google originally, I think he was from Kleiner Perkins. He saw the deal, and they said, "Oh, we don't make any money." He said, How many visitors do you have?" He says, "Well, 1 million people search." And the guy said, "If there's 1 million people searching, we'll figure out how to make money off of it." Right? So it's who the people are, how the vision is, and how it can evolve and change over time. If 1 million people are doing something, there is something there. Now, how do we do it? And that's the coachability and working together as partners. The other thing that I look for is for people who are not looking for my money. Now, that may sound silly. They should look at the VCs first as what that VC brings to the table. Do they have the right chemistry between them? Do they have the trust between them? Because that's what's going to get them through the tough times. Most entrepreneurs say, give me the money, I know what to do. That's not the case. The value that the right investor brings to the table is a lot more than the money that they can give you.
Right, so the last part that you said about the value a VC brings instead of money, we should focus on that value. What do you think a VC can bring to the table besides of money? What should entrepreneurs really focus on, especially when it comes to SaaS businesses and e-commerce businesses?
So there are, so see that, let me replace VC with an investor because they're different. You could have an angel investor, you could have a venture capital investor, you could have a group of investors that come in. So A, if they know your business, that's an advantage because you don't have to educate them. They've been through this road. They know some things that work and don't work, and they have connections in that space. B, so that's A. You should look for people who know your business. For example, so VCs that make investments in B2C are usually very frustrated with B2B investments because sales cycles are different, blah, 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 blah. VCs that are focused on companies that are manufacturing things like a product are very different than people who are purely software SaaS because you could put code in and you could deploy it. That's very different, and you could change the directions much, much faster than if you have to produce a product and you need inventory, and if there's a flaw in something and then you need to have the inventory paid for before you have sold it. It's a different business. So if they know your business, that's an advantage. The second is you have different kind of investors. You have people that are good for scaling the business for the next stage. What? They can bring in the heavy lifter investors for your next round. They can get the news coverage just by doing a tweet on you. So if Mr. Elon Musk is your investor, he can make a tweet and your life is changed. If I am your investor, that doesn't help you. Now, you have also a group of investors, and the earlier you are, these are the most valuable, who have actually built the startup. They're not administrators of the fund. They didn't do it 20 years ago. They have actively built a company. So they really understand your cash flow challenges, your market challenges, your positioning challenges. Those guys bring a different set of capabilities to you, which is significant in the first few million dollars. Those skill sets are not significant to you when you get to be a $100 million company. Right? Then you have people that come in on the board and you get them on, or you have advice that are exit focused. Exit focused means I'm an expert in packaging an exit, positioning an exit, bringing it in, negotiating it, and so forth. Right? So, depending on where you are in your life cycle, you need different people. But the early stage, you need somebody who understands, believes you, you trust them, so you listen to them, and has done this from an operational perspective. So, a CFO of a big company that becomes a kind of a VC doesn't know how to help you or guide you through this, but they are excellent when you get to the next level of having corporate relationships, for example. because they have a Rolodex of those people that they can do. So you need to have, as a startup, a blend of those people, and it just kind of changes and evolves at your stage of the company gets bigger.
Right, so about a month ago, we helped a startup raise about, I think, 7.8 million through doing cold outreach for investors. And what I told them was the right investor can take you from zero to however fast you want to go. The thing is, we do not want an investor, right? The way we approached it is first we got a hero investor, which was really well versed in that specific niche that they were building their SaaS business in. And once we got that initial pledge of investment from that investor, that angel, it was much easier to get investment pledges from other VCs, right? And on
Yes.
the other
Yes.
hand, I used to do some consulting and advisement for a fund here. And what used to happen was the fund was comprised of people investing their family money, right? And their incentive to invest was completely different, and their way to contribute to your business was completely different. If there was some sort of contribution in the first place, it was completely different from those founder turned investors, right? So if you were starting a business right now and seeking VC investment, what would be the sort of questions you would ask your VCs to make sure that they'll be able to contribute to your business something aside from their investment?
Yeah. So the first thing is I'll try to qualify them to make sure they understand what the hell we do. That's the first thing. The second thing is you just define the different kinds of investors. A family office investor is very different than a VC investor. A family office investor, they have real estate investments, they have market investments, they have REIT investments, they have a lot of different things, and the new generation want to take a piece of that. So, for example, there is a family office of the people that started the Sprouts. Sprouts is a kind of, we have Ralph's, we have these grocery stores. So they understand the grocery business, they understand how to deliver things and get work with people and so forth. So, when they were looking for investments, maybe Lemonade came up, which is a great fit for them because they understand it. And yeah, it's an extension of what they do, but they have all those relationships. They understand the margins, they understand the spoilage, they understand all that sort of stuff. So they can value that. And also, they've got connections within that space that they can immediately drop you in. So, what kind of investments they've made in the past is also important. What did they do? Now, there is another thing I should mention. Not all, I mean, yeah, I have something that's a search business. So should I go to all the investors of Google because it's a search business? Well, maybe not. They've already invested in that. They've already, and they somehow trusted the first time and made and helped that company grow. So it's not like if they haven't done or been in that business, they're useless. Again, if they get what you're doing and they can help you get there, it's more valuable than having a big name and then it's just a name and they're not doing anything for you.
Right, so I would love to keep talking about VCs and pitch decks, but I also want to talk about your books. Can you tell us so where should we start reading your books?
So I think for the focus of your audience, I have my first book is called The Caterpillar's Edge. It's about evolving and evolving again and thriving in business. That's a few years old, and it was in those days I had the last chapter says the 2-minute warning, and it's about the introduction of AI before all of this hoopla and says, hey, it's coming. Here's what's going to happen. It's about using of analytics. It's about shedding your addictions to sameness and so forth and so on. The second book, which I think is more relevant, is called You Are Not Them. You Are Not Them is the authentic pathway to entrepreneurship and creating your mindset. So in that book, the first, if you would, the first pointer comes from the name of the book that begins, says, you're not Elon Musk, neither am I, you're not Jeff Bezos, you're not. So you have to build your own entrepreneurial philosophy to succeed. The other is, what is an entrepreneur? And I will define that in terms of a different way.
Okay, so Sid, tell us more about your book, right? You were telling us about entrepreneurs building their own philosophy to start their businesses. What do you have to say about that?
Well, yeah, so I have two books. The first one is about business in general and use of analytics, and also giving up your addictions to sameness. That book is called The Caterpillar's Edge, Evolve, Evolve, Gain, and Thrive in Business. The second one, which is more entrepreneur focused, is about it's titled You Are Not Them, The Authentic Entrepreneur's Way, which is from the book's name, the name of the book, you can kind of conclude certain things that suggest that you're not them. You are you, as every entrepreneur has a different mindset and has to build their own philosophy. So it's all about how do you build your mindset and philosophy to win. It's not a how-to. There's a lot of how-to books that say how to market this, how to do accounting, how to do this. This is mostly on shaping your mindset, because that then you have the right tools to apply the right how-tos at the right time. It includes a discussion about risk, how do you manage it like a pilot. It includes a chapter around your oceanness, looking at how creating waves of energy within the business and how do you create the ecosystem. It has a chapter around your authentic leadership and how you can become an authentic leader. It has a chapter titled Be a Dancer, which is about how do you read the timing of business. And it's not pivoting, because it's a different animal. It's about, and then a lot of stuff about dealing with nervousness and fear and all of that stuff that comes into play. So that's the second book. Again, it's called You Are Not Them, The Authentic Entrepreneur's Way. And it's on Amazon. And it's you've got the audio, you've got the digital, you've got all different forms of it. For those people that may be interested, I do a lot of things. I have a couple of TEDx talks. The most recent one is called Are You the Artist or the Entrepreneur? That may appeal to them as entrepreneurs. And I have significant number of articles from The Independent to Foreign Policy to USA Today, Time, Newsweek, and Harvard Business Review, and others that if they search my name, they can find a lot of them and see if they like it. So that's kind of who I am, and hopefully folks can benefit from the 40 years of experience that I've had and I've tried to share.
Okay, so thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And guys, I'm going to leave the links to his TED Talk and his books in the description. There is another thing I do want to ask you, right? So you are a professor, and something I've been personally struggling with is this, right? I've been in business for about 15 years, and I've built about at least three businesses that I've been very happy with. I've sold two of them, but I still sometimes feel like, because I do a lot of consulting and with VCs and startups and other business owners, and I feel like I should get an MBA or something, or maybe get a master's in statistics because my bachelor's was in mathematics. So what advice do you have for founders who want to pursue education instead of dropping out, especially education after the bachelor's?
So education is for what purpose? If the education is to get a job at a big company, yes, you need an MBA to do that. If the education is for the purposes of learning, then you don't need to. You can read all the books in the world. There's, an ocean. It just needs a commitment for you to do that. The main thing is nowadays with internet, there's lots of people, lots of podcasts, lots of articles, lots of things you have access to that would get you that, that extra thing. But the key that I wanted to mention, if you're in business, the main thing is to not only listen to podcasts or read a book, it's also to listen to everybody because you win because of the relevance in the market. So that's what gets the difference. If you learn how to listening, and how to apply that and turn it into a business or into an opportunity, that's a lot more valuable than getting a degree and putting it on the wall. It's good for your kids, but so I'm not against education. I want to make sure I'm not against learning. I'm not about against reading. But the purpose of it is for what? If you've built all these businesses, then you've had something. But the fact of going to a business school, would it teach you some stuff? Of course it would. Would it, can you get that from other places? Yes, you can. So it's not that paper, that degree that gives you credibility or ability to execute well. It's your commitment to listening and learning that does that.
Personally, I do a lot of reading and I do not listen to a lot of podcasts. I do have a few selected ones, but still, you can read a book, but you can't put it up your wall, right? I don't know if it's the Asian DNA I have within me, but
That's
if
what I'm
I am
saying.
gonna
If you
have
want to put it
kids,
on
if
the
you wanna put
wall,
it
that's
on
a
the
different
wall, that's a
story,
different
right?
story. So if I'm gonna have kids, I am not gonna be want I'm not gonna be a hypocrite or something, right? I'm gonna want them to pursue business like me, but I also want them to get a proper education, right? So for those of us or for guys who are in my audience who are still in college, what advice do you have to start their business when they're in college and utilize their college credentials and their ability to attend that college to their advantage to run and grow their business?
So I started my first business when I was in college. It was a long time ago, but there are advantages as a college student that you don't have when you get out. One is you have a lot of resources. You get access to cloud, you get access to this, your ability to tap into all sorts of research that you would have to pay for otherwise is massive. So you have access to a lot of intelligence and reports that you wouldn't if you're outside of school. You also have a little bit of room to error, meaning that if you talk to people about your product or whatever, and you say, "Hey, I'm a student doing this," they're more willing to help you than if you just call somebody and says, "Hey, I'm having a business, I want to do that." So people are more forgiving. And more willing to share with you their thoughts and opinions and wisdom. So I'm all about taking advantage of that. Of when you're in school, you have some advantages. The problem is if you compromise one or the other, that is, you'll say, "Oh, I'm here just to do a business, so I don't want to learn." So one issue I have, I'll tell you. I teach MBA students and master's students only. I don't teach undergrad. And most of the students nowadays come to school and come to in class, but they don't show up because my classes are in the evening and they say, "Oh, there is a such and such meeting with Deloitte, such and such meeting with IBM, such and such meeting with some." So they're just there to get a job. They're not there to learn. So their priority is to secure the job. And that's a problem. So they don't care what they're getting in here. They're just there to get into some other, it's a stepping stone to something else. Where if you're doing it because of what it gives you, which is the learning and the experience, then you're completely focused on it. So if you're looking at that as a stepping stone to something else, and you ignore the studying and the learning and the teamwork and the experimentation with it, then you don't get much out of it.
Right, so thank you so much for joining us, Sid. This episode has been a moment of clarity, both personally and as a founder. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience with us. Okay, and I hope you are gonna join us in the next season again. Okay.
My pleasure,
All
Ray.
right.
My pleasure.